Hi, I'm Dan Cottrell, editor of Rugby Coach Weekly. You're about to jump into one of our podcasts. If you want to find out more about this podcast and also all of the great content, drills, activities, games and advice on the website, then go over to www.rugbycoachweekly.net. I hope you enjoy the podcast.
There's no actual research within sport to support the idea that we have a preferred learning style. There's a couple of pieces of research within education, but there's actually nothing within the sport coaching literature. Yet, for me, that's probably one of the most talked about concepts within coach education over the last, 20 years.
Be the best rugby coach you can be. Welcome to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast with head coach Dan Cottrell, where you learn hints and tips from the rugby coaching community. Let's get started.
Hello and welcome to the Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast. I'm delighted to welcome along the two editors of Myths of Sports Coaching, Dr. Amy Whitehead and Jenny Coe. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks for having us.
Quick introduction. Dr. Amy Whitehead is Associate Professor at Liverpool John Moores University, and Jenny is Performance Wellbeing Lead for the Women's Professional Game at the FA. In the first edition of the Myths of Sports Coaching, it was so good that they've been persuaded to do a second edition, which is coming out later on this year. In the first book, they invited experts to delve into the myths around areas like learning styles, deliberate practice, coaching women differently, and fundamental movement. So I'm really pleased that they've come onto the podcast, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the book and a little bit about the upcoming book, and probably going to wander off into some other areas as well. So let's start with the idea that some myths are more pervasive than others. So as you reflect back, which ones are the most significant in terms of how a coach might need to reflect on what they might change? So I'll go to Amy first.
Yeah, I'll kick off with that, Dan. I think there is a bit of a theme in the book because we've got a few chapters that link together around gender. So I think that's, for me, probably one of the most significant ones. And definitely if we think about the times that we're in now, there's a big push around understanding the female athlete. So I think that's quite a significant theme within the book. And I do think it's a really important topic that we need coaches to think about and reflect on. So we've got like Amanda Visek, who did the chapter around fun. So although that chapter doesn't initially appear to be around gender, it talks about the differences between male, like boys and girls, and how we think boys and girls perceive fun in different ways, but actually they don't from a young age. It's in a nutshell, it's we socially construct what we think gender should be. So as parents, as coaches, we coach in different ways, which then develops or perpetuates this idea that, you know, girls should be one thing and boys should be another. Luke, in one of the chapters around a different kettle of fish, again talks about coaches coaching older athletes and how, again, there's this idea that, you know, we have to coach these women differently because they're so different. And for me, it's not necessarily about, you know, gender. It's just about knowing the individual. And again, I think that's a theme that runs through the whole book, is about understanding the person that you're working with. So whether it's the myth around learning styles, who cares about learning styles? We care about learning, but we should invest more time in the person and their biography rather than their specific learning styles, which doesn't have any evidence within coaching. So yeah, I could probably go through each and every chapter and be like,
we go back to the one on the fun chapter, which is a fascinating chapter, one of the ones I jumped to first of all. And you say that there is no difference between what boys and girls find fun. Can you give me some of the examples of what we have mistakenly thought girls thought was fun? And also the other thing I wonder is that do girls think they're having fun because they've been told they're having fun?
Oh, good question. I'll start, but I know Jen's pretty passionate about this chapter as well. So Jen, I'll let you jump in as well.
Yeah, for sure.
So if we look at even like literally the day children are born, yeah, straight away a girl baby is put in a certain colored room versus a boy. Boys are encouraged to be more competitive, more aggressive. You know, you hear the term boys will be boys. Like, I saw a friend had a little boy, a big lump on his head because he was like playing rough and tumble. But she's got a little girl as well, but she doesn't talk about a girl in the same way. Boys are girls are kind of taught to be polite, to be kind, to be gentle. So if we use this type of language with gender from such a young age, then we're assuming that girls don't like to be competitive and to be physical, whereas boys do. So that's the kind of the way in which we approach. And if we're talking about, like, this is so broad, but if we're talking about coaching, the language that coaches use is very important when we consider these things. Jen, what do you think?
Yeah, no, I think you've nailed it. There's, the simple stuff of going to Google and typing in boy sport and girl sport and the images that are fed back to you. The idea that at some point, back decades, we had people taking a tutor's course who, at the time, there was a massive disparity and we weren't even getting to the point of having a conversation. And when I say disparity, Ben, like the boys are in this bucket, the girls are in this bucket, and this is how we coach them. And then they go on and coach people who then become tutors. And we're at a stage where we're hopefully healthily challenging those things that have been perpetuated and carried over the years. And having been on the ground across a multitude of different sports, it is becoming a topic that people kind of start to raise the antenna and go, do you think they are different, or do you think it is different here? And I heard this at a webinar, which is so brilliant. But there are other coaches who are sitting in a pocket, goes, oh, these women, they need to know everything. They need to know all the details, or they're not as competitive. And I'm like, I can just talk for me, but I have been around so many intensely competitive, driven women across all stages of the pathway, present company included. Amy Whitehead. And their attention to detail can be given or taken around certain areas, but it's as Amy said there in the coaching, the language and the mindset and the biases that they're carrying into that, whatever intention, positive or negative, we just need to keep challenging those so they're not carried, or you understand the human beings you have in front of you. So yeah.
And
Is
just
it perpetuated by women coaches as much as men coaches?
Dan. What a great question now, and you're stirring the pot right up here. My immediate thought, and then Amy, you'd definitely jump in here. My immediate thought is, where are the women at, Dan? No, I'm joking. once you
No,
go
you're
to
not. That's a
yeah,
silly, that's a silly
yeah, I
question.
know. There's many pots I could stir. When we do see women get to the further up the pathway in coaching, and we celebrate them for breaking whatever barriers and persevering through, and that, yeah. That's a bit heavy, I understand. But what we do have then is some women, unfortunately, have molded or masked their coaching or morphed themselves into what they think they need to be and think they need to present in order to get to that point. But deeply underneath that, there is somebody who is connecting with somebody else of coach to athlete, athlete to coach that can connect. So there is some research that say that women are connected and that connective doesn't need to have a formal qualification, that they can understand and be empathic. I challenge that because I've seen very in very good coaches who are very empathic and very much have their finger on the pulse and use the right language and or like good language to connect with. So I think there are some women who get to a point in their career who've maybe come from being a player to a coach, who've been coached in a certain way, who are presenting a version that they think needs to be presented. And it takes a little bit longer for them to really own their position and really coach the way they want to coach, whether that is carrying this myth with them or not, is another side of things.
So when I get women telling me that we are wired differently and we ask lots more questions, do I then say to them, well, I wouldn't say you're talking rubbish, it's a myth. How would I then change my conversation with them to say, well, actually, you're not different. You're just like anybody else. I've got to treat you as an individual as opposed to the gender in front of me.
So I'd flip that actually, because I think we're being really unfair to men when we're coaching men, because I always hear coaches say, oh, coaching men is so easy, just tell them what to do and they do it. And you're almost saying that these men are just like mindless individuals that take, like robots that take on instructions, and they don't think, they just do because they don't ask questions. Now, I would challenge that and say, well, why don't they ask questions? You know, why aren't you having open discussions and encouraging the questions within these coaching sessions? So, and to go answer your question, Dan, I think some of us are wired differently because our wiring has been programmed from such a young age. So if you and I are treated differently from birth, where you are, you know, encouraged to be more competitive and not to ask questions, and I'm encouraged to be more sociable and kind, and that might lead to me wanting more questions, then yeah, of course we're going to be wired differently. But I think what we're trying to challenge is, why do we do that with these young people from such a young age, to program these people to be like they are? Because I think there will be men that want to ask questions or do ask questions. And there might be women who just want to be told what to do and get on with it. But we've created such generalizations that we now coach these two groups in very, like, quite different ways.
So the conclusion really is coach the person in front of you, whether they're male or female, and you have to understand that some of the people who arrive at your training sessions have had different experiences based on their gender, which mean that you do have to understand that that's where they're coming from. Or is that the right sort of summary of where you're getting to on that?
Yeah, if you use an example of well-being or mental health, if we perceive, which I have heard conversations, that women need more nurturing and we need to look after them and care and maybe be very selective in our language, but we can be a bit more aggressive or bantery because men are strong, just stereotyping there. I've seen and lived experiences like that, and actually the men are really struggling. And they could do with a nurturing conversation, and they could do with an arm around the shoulder, and they could do with a, you know, how's life outside this sporting arena? There is a danger in that, and not seeing the human being, the wider context of it. But having those conversations and being mindful of, being mindful of the person behind the badge, the jersey, or whatever it is.
Okay, so I mean that's I suppose the one thing you're talking about is one of the most pervasive myths is the difference between coaching men and women. Are there other ones in there? I mean, obviously that's a pretty important one. Are there other ones in there where you're thinking it'd be very good if we slayed this myth because it's really holding coaches back?
Yeah, halfway through the book, the first book of Myths of Sports Coaching, we realized that there was so many more that we could include. And actually, there was a wider performance support team. So in some sports, where they, you know, might start, for whatever reason, resource or whatever, with just an athlete or a group of athletes and a coach, there's a whole now wider performance support team that's growing behind various. So the myths that we started to uncover as the webinars, actually, we had a webinar a month on the back of that first book, which the recordings can be seen on the YouTube channel of the publisher, Sequoia. We started to see in the chat box and conversations that when the authors brought the chapters to life, of how the myths were kind of being busted within organizations and clubs, but what other ones were appearing and how we needed to kind of address those. And there's some really obvious ones that we've engaged in the new book around sleep. This whole idea, which is very prevalent in my world at the moment of women's professional sport, is being a good mother and an elite athlete are not compatible. And so we see there are some great examples. Jasmine Paris the other day has two children and is, you know, setting historical records in achieving in her industry. We've got footballers, West Ham Dagny, Brynja Stottier, and Katrina Gorry, talking live about having children within a season. So there's some examples there, but there are also this chapter, and there's another chapter as well, because it's such a prevalent myth to dive into, that gives a difference, gives some perspective and some research behind this for people to think about. Another one, and we had a combo of authors, great, great authors and practitioners on the ground, Winning Matters Most in Elite Sport. It's a term that when I worked across various sports, I hear the word winning. There's a lot of weight put on that, talking about commodities and products, being the athletes, which we would love to get away from. This chapter really dives into the reality of that and unpicks that. Another one that is, again, quite prevalent. I'm seeing a lot of webinars, and we're so lucky to have a couple of great authors contributing to this chapter, is around psychological safety and the balance of that. So you can have maybe harmony and productivity working simultaneously in an environment. So that's a myth that we wanted to explore, that in some of these webinars that we're seeing, people are talking a lot about the what of psych safety, but not the how, and not kind of the finer granular details. So it's really good in I guess, bringing this myth to the forefront and saying, okay, let's have a look at it and dive into that. So
let's have a quick think about that one in particular. So psychological safety, what do you understand by that?
So and are you okay with me heading?
Yeah, go for it.
I think in very simple terms, it's a living and breathing version of high challenge, high support, where people feel safe to express their opinions, to challenge the norms or ways of working, and to have kind of critical thinking, living and breathing in the environment. And that's
so can you give me an example of that? So from say like when you're at West Ham, what would be something that someone could say which would be powerful but safe?
Yeah, so it could appear in different questions. So if we're in a multidisciplinary team meeting, it could be a case that somebody's brought something to the forefront, maybe about an athlete. So we would chat about all of the athletes over the course of the month and different stages they were at. And somebody in the medical department or physical head of sports science might present something. And you know, we could feel free from a coaching, an analysis technical point of view, a psychology point of view, to check and challenge that. Maybe somebody brings a piece of research to the forefront to either back something up they're talking about or to present it, and we would feel safe to check and challenge that. That's a light touch example. I think there would be other ones that are a bit meatier, where different roles across different sports have different levels of hierarchy, even though we might not want to admit that. So it's, if I am somebody who's coming in, which actually I could give an example as at West Ham, of where we had an intern, a couple of interns who would present stuff or have conversations. So even though you may not be perceived to be the top decision maker or one of the key decision makers or the manager of the team, you are able to voice an opinion and go, oh, have we thought about this? There's a way of doing it. There's a way of introducing and check and challenging and sharing. But there's an awareness from everybody in the room of maybe who hasn't spoken and how we might respond to something that we maybe the concept would be sitting with the difference. Just a healthy sit with the difference instead of being reactive, because it's different to how you see things. It's different to the way maybe you thought there was only one way of getting from A to B, and now people are inviting various other angles. So.
So I think you mentioned right at the start about of this conversation about productivity. So is there not an opportunity cost of getting things done because you're spending so much time discussing everything else? Where at what stage do you say, actually, we've got to get on and make a decision here? We can't spend all this time checking, challenging everything else. We've actually got to drive forward. And if it's not quite right, well, we're just going to have to park it. How do we get that balance right?
I think Amy Edmondson's work, so Amy Edmondson, who came up with like the term psychological safety, is from business. So she was actually looking at the more successful successful companies in the world. Was it, I think Google was one of them, wasn't it, Jen?
Yeah.
And basically, like, so I'd say they're pretty productive and a pretty successful company. So she was showing that there is a relationship between psychological safety and like product business success. So I don't think it's necessarily we are psychological safety is where we can all sit around and discuss at length. It's more it creates more creativity because I'm more comfortable to come up with a wacky idea or to, you know, to share my thoughts and not feel like I'm going to get ridiculed or you know, told off for
Well, sorry, I can certainly jump in. I can certainly see that with someone like Google, but Google obviously has an enormous amount of resources
yeah.
and can afford to fail on a number of projects because it has other projects which are ongoing. But in a performance environment, we're talking a little bit about West Ham, where they are in the table and that sort of thing, then the pressure must be on still. And someone might be saying, "Well, just a moment, that was great. We've just spent this week we spent 4 or 5 hours doing these great meetings, but we've got a game to win on the weekend." At what stage does someone say, "Yeah, that's lovely, but there's some practical things going on at the moment"?
I think you're slightly missing the point. Sorry,
Oh yeah, well,
Dan.
definitely, I could be definitely missing the point. So, what do I need to change in the way that I'm thinking about this?
I think, are you thinking of, you've got hierarchy, you've got one person top making all decisions, right? And they're making the decisions and the cracking on. Is that kind of what you're
Well,
saying?
I'm
You're
saying that I'm thinking that you're in a management group trying to week in, week out produce a team which you obviously want to win more than you want to lose. I mean, there are obviously other factors involved. Some teams are always going to be aiming to win the league, someone just wants to survive. And you're spending quite a lot of time on this check and challenge, psychological safety part, which is clearly important, but there are other things which are given up in order to do that, which might be other, which you might say, why are we giving these things up? We should actually be spending more time on this.
Okay, I'll generally let you jump in a sec, but from my perspective, I think all a manager has to do is say, right, I've got half an hour here. I'm happy to hear everyone's thoughts. Let's have a quick discussion. It doesn't mean that the manager has to go with everyone's discussion or has to fully explore everyone's thoughts and discussions. It's just to sh like that people feel heard and feel that, you know, there is maybe they have contributed because otherwise, well, what are they doing there? And also, if what the manager's doing isn't working, then he needs input and he needs ideas or she to be able to generate, you know, an improvement in performance. But well, go on, Jen.
No, I'll just tail it. It's a really great conversation. I think one of the chapters in the new book is on leadership. The title is actually a title bestowed from above. Jane Booth writes a great chapter on the position awarded and power. And I think if you look at the evolution of leaders and leading and incorporate psych safety, I think there's still, as if you zoom out, you've got a high performing team that has a common vision or a goal. And I see this as I go to different clubs across the women's Super League and Championship. They've got a common goal. Then we've got people understanding procedures and processes and how we interact. And I think if you have those in place, like Amy was saying, of we've got regular meetings in place, we've got different people facilitating and bringing stuff to the table. It isn't that people should feel, I guess this is the harmony and productivity. It isn't that people should feel done on to if their opinion isn't taken as the gold standard. It is just that we're contributing. We understand the vision and the direction of travel, and we're contributing to something. Now, there is, you know, another one of our strands in our strategy was to diversify staff and to really get that thought within the environments churning. And I think this is what we're seeing across the women's professional game is that some people are coming into the environments from outside football and they feel safe that even though they don't know the depths and breadths of football, which again, a role that I lived in and breathed at West Ham, I still had a seat at the table to have a conversation. But we didn't become an echo chamber because we brought interns who were constantly looking at research and the latest, who felt like they could contribute and kind of say, well, actually, I saw something the other day, it might be useful to share. And you're not looking at a hierarchy of a manager of the department or a head of somebody saying, no, your voice isn't important. So there's something that's a more kind of clinical maybe angle and example. But I think site safety also can be the harmony and culture that's created on the back of that in the corridor conversations and the organic growth of a team to problem solve.
So just going, I mean, I was going to talk about goal setting because obviously that's one of the chapters, but I'm going to jump past that and go on to the idea that you've got interns and other people bringing new research into the space to talk about. And obviously one piece of research on its own doesn't necessarily mean everything's got to change. You've got to have more and more meta-analysis and so on. So how much evidence do you think needs to be until a finding becomes a myth? So we've obviously, some people have found things in the past, and then eventually enough research comes out to say, well, actually, when we say it's a myth may be not the right word, but it just, it's, there's not enough evidence to suggest this works. So, I mean, do you think that some of your myths might then become facts again one day when research comes about out? I mean, what's the process which takes it over the line into mythical status?
I don't think there's like a magic number. Although I bet you could probably find someone that's got a mathematical equation that says this many studies versus this many studies. Like the goal setting chapter, I think that talks about how there's a lot of inconclusive research. There's similar with kind of a lot of mental skills research shows inconclusive evidence. But I think when I was thinking about this question, the learning styles chapter for me, that was really interesting in that there's no evidence, there's no actual research within sport to support the idea that we have a preferred learning style. There's a couple of pieces of research within education, but there's actually nothing within the sport coaching literature yet. For me, that's probably one of the most talked about concepts within coach education over the last, I don't know, 20 years, sir. And we know, like Jen and I have been on webinars with coach educators and national governing bodies, and they're still, and they're admittingly so, talking about how, or this is still in our coach education, like level X, Y, and Z qualification. And it's because it's easy, it's like it's understandable, and it kind of makes sense because we can put ourselves in boxes, but there's just not enough evidence, or there's no evidence to say it's a useful thing for us to be focused on when we're coaching athletes.
Is it the case that anything which can be made into a pyramid is probably a myth?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the learning styles one has been, I mean, I remember talking about it as if it was fact in 2006, and
I
then,
did too.
yeah, and we've probably all done it,
Yeah.
and then sort of then questioning it about 2010, and I mean, it's amazing, it's still there. So, which other ones are on sort of on the cusp then, which are worth debate? I mean, obviously the debate we've been having about gender, it seems to be on the cusp of, there's a lot more debate about it, where the learning styles is pretty much, what other ones are, this is a, and the other thing is to have also, I think Mark Partington in his chapter on questioning talks about the false dichotomies which comes across like drills versus games. What other ones are in that sort of, this is an interesting discussion when we haven't got there yet.
Yeah, well, I think the goal setting chapter is really interesting, the way, like, I guess smart goals, and that there's,
Sorry, are smart goals a myth? I just want to just check.
well, so if you look at Laura Healey's chapter, I'm not going to say people shouldn't use SMART goals, talk about SMART goals or anything like that, because it might work for some people, but the research and the evidence isn't strong enough to say one way or the other. But we could critique research in itself and say maybe the studies weren't robust enough, the sample sizes, SMART goals might work for certain people in certain situations. So there's very context specific nature. So it's a really good question, Dan, that, to be honest, Jen, I haven't really thought about too much, because I think the psychological safety chapter, like if you I'm going to open a can of worms now, but if you look at like Dave Collins and Jamie Taylor's work, they kind of rip psychological safety to pieces and say like, psychological safety doesn't exist in high performance sport, and they don't advocate for not being psychologically safe, but they really challenge the notion of it, and that it can't be, or that there's not an easy translation or transference from business to sport. Jen, any
Yeah.
other
No, I
chapters?
think I'll just tail again what you're saying there, as I'm nodding along. I think there's something about the cotton, there's something about the evolution of the role of a coach that puts extra needs and pressure on coaches, or perceived pressure on coaches. So there is a lure towards the copy and paste. There is a lure towards a shortcut. And I think sometimes where the mitts can be really helpful and useful is that, yes, SMART goals, if we just stay on that for a second, can work, but they're also something that's easy. It's commercialized. It's, well, commercialized as such, but it's easy to put it on a visual. It's an acronym. It's connecting with people in a way they go, oh, I'll grab that and go. And then they're on this conveyor belt for such a long period of time that they either don't have a wider team that are safe and check and challenging, or people are not stopping to do CPD that's outside formal qualifications, or their experience with engaging in very various types of learning is quite boxed off. So yes, it may work, or you may force it to work for a period of time. But yeah, I think it's just adapting with your context and your people over time. And that sometimes we're just it's unfortunate that coaches feel like they should be a psychologist, which is something that I find really interesting. Or coaches are now tuning into things around well-being, and I should have all the right answers, and I should be the mental health expert. Or coaches might feel that beyond tech tack, that I should have more soft skills, so I need to be more empathic or have higher levels of emotional intelligence. So whilst all this kind of is coming to the forefront around neurodiversity as well, I need to really understand it. Yes, absolutely, as we're working with people, a dynamic, complex environment of sport, there is a demand. But you know the shortcutting is, who do I need to have around me? And there's actually a great chapter that Andy Bradshaw's going to be sharing with us in the book around coach development and mentoring. Who do I need to have around me to help me on this journey, to navigate and explore and unpick this in a way that is at a pace that I can work with? So there's definitely some other myths around the resilience chapter, the coaching 24/7. I'd like to say that that isn't a thing anymore, but it is. It is. We're still trying to shake that off, you know, especially in elite performance sport where you are replaceable. I speak to globally to loads of friends working in spaces where they go, if I check and challenge the norm, I might be out the door. If I say things are not good enough, or if I say I want more salary, or whatever the case may be, I might be out the door, and they can get somebody cheaper to come in and do a job. So there's definitely some of them that have moved on, and through those webinars, Amy and I have seen so much of people saying, yeah, we've changed the curriculum in our organization. I've had some great coaching conversations that now we understand X, Y, and Z a little bit more. Or I actually went back into coaching, or I'm a parent and now I see things with a different lens. So, but there is definitely some stuff around the language and understanding a little bit more of the research, I think.
I think it's quite scary. What you're saying is that we often think we've moved on as coaches. We should be more than tech tack. We need to have all these other skills, and we'd be studying for years to be able to have a real handle on it. And sometimes it's quite scary when we are faced with some of these problems that you put up. And I suppose, as you say, if you have something like a SMART goal or something like that, it's quite quick to hang on to. I think someone else, another person who's written around this, Carl Hendrick, said that if anything was an acronym, you need to watch out for as well. So GROW and SMART and that sort of thing. And as you say, they work in certain contexts, but not in other contexts. So just talking about a bit about some of the authors, and I suppose this is a challenge for you as editors, is that some of these authors are going to have very vested interest in a certain area of research because they've spent a lot of time in it. It shows what they believe, and inevitably, they're going to go, be going out to find more evidence that their area is valid, and it needs to be one that we need to look at. How do we discern that validity of research? Because I will see lots of papers come out. We've mentioned a couple of authors. You've mentioned a couple of authors. I know roughly what's going to come from them. I know what's roughly what's going to come from another set of authors. And so I'm sort of trying, using the word lens, trying to work out what have I got to try and pick out? Because in the end, on a Monday night at 9 o'clock, I'm faced with 32 girls who I'm treating as individuals, not as girls. And I've got to coach. Where do I, where, what do you do to make sure that they're not just, this is my drum, I'm going to bang it louder? Is there a question in there?
I think there will always be bias, and we can never avoid that. And I think you're right, there are certain authors that were very vocal on like social media, like pushing their ideas and their work. I guess all I would say is be aware of that. And that's difficult for a coach who maybe that's all they get access to. But I think that's the whole point of the book. It's not to tell people that if they have been using learning styles or goal setting or whatever, that they're terrible people and they really shouldn't be doing that. It's just to make them question the why, and is this right for me? So yeah, it is tough. I think most researchers do research because they really believe that it's improving, especially in coaching, like it's a very practical subject. So we do the research because we believe it's improving practice. But I don't think you can ever completely remove bias from anything.
I mean, sorry, I'm obviously, Jenny, we're going to go to your mind. Have you come across researchers? I mean, we've all changed our mind on things who've almost had a St. Paul's Damascene moment where they've said, actually, I used to go down this route and now I've changed my mind because that's a pretty big thing to do.
Yeah, I've done that myself with
All
research.
right. Okay. Are you allowed to tell us what it is?
Yeah,
You're
like
in a
so.
psychologically safe space, remember.
So my PhD, my early research was asking people to verbalize what they're thinking as they're performing, and I'm claiming that I can understand their decision-making process just by their verbalizations. Now, it's my interpretation of what they're thinking. So unless I so but back then I was like, yeah, like use this method, you can really understand people's thought processes. But actually, if I don't go back to them and get their interpretation of this data that I'm interpreting, then like it's just what I think. So it's very kind of one-sided, but that's a problem with research. So this is a much bigger issue, in that we do interviews, for example, with coaches, and we analyze the data based on our lens, our bias, and our interpretation of what we think they're telling us. And no, like researchers started to do this, and this is kind of in qualitative research is kind of gold standard. It's actually sitting down with the coach and saying, I've interpreted your data in this way. Do you agree? Is this what you said and how you meant it? Because any research that has been done with just the researcher is just their interpretation. So sorry, I'm going off on a bit of a research method
No, I
tangent.
think that's. I find that's a real challenge because often we ask questions, and in the moment, someone comes up with an answer. And Esprit d'Escalier, they think later, actually, what I really meant was this. And then when they read what they said, did I actually say that? So, I mean, I think that's a real challenge within questioning. Jen, what do you think on terms of mind changes? Not necessarily you've changed your mind, but you've come across researchers who've changed their minds.
Well, because you've taught me it's a psychologically safe place, I feel super safe now, Dan, so I
Okay,
can
well,
move
that's right. Well, I told you, see, so that must work.
No, I thought that was brilliant. That was absolutely brilliant. I think Amy's mentioned in introducing the word awareness that if we look even in a really simplistic way at our social media, and who might be in that. So who's on my feed? Are they all people who are just, publishing things that are in my channel, not disrupting my thought? Have I the awareness and the diluted ego enough to realize that my way is not the only way to do something? And that's a great starting point, that if I can engage with something and sit with that difference, then I am in a great starting point to realize that there's a multitude of different ways to engage with something. And I think that then leads into when you have a group of, as you said, 20 or 30 people in front of you, how great that is that you have that brilliant setup of people in front of you that you can kind of go, right, this is a mixed bag. I now have some volunteers, I have some parents, I have loads of different people in this environment, all with a thought and a view of how things are moving. And I can use all that. And so I think there's something about, there's a reason we have 32 authors contributing to the first book and just on the cusp of 40 in the second book, because and it's global. There's 12 countries in the first book included. We didn't write a book just from a UK Western Europe perspective. We wanted to be as global as possible in the reach. People who are at the forefront, who've not just done one or two studies or worked, for one or two years in a space. We're trying to see, as wide as we can and as deep as we can on these really important topics. But there will be, and there's a reason in the second book, there'll be more. There'll be people who've said, actually, Amy's produced something that's really interesting. I could use it in this environment and it's worked amazing. In this, in context, it's slightly different and I need to understand a little bit more. And I don't think it's as, I think, there's loads of topics that we're presented with from a marketing and commercial perspective that we just need to understand a little bit more. I had a conversation internally the other day about wearables. I can see loads of people have different wearables in rings and watches and what they tell you, but not understanding how to interpret it and actually the impact it could have by seeing all these numbers and not knowing how to fix or not know really what they mean. So it's really about, I think, educating yourself and having a broad scope of people around you that have different perspectives.
I think I definitely need to dilute my ego. I'm going to work hard at that, and I think that's something which I need to think about. So, just to sort of this is the last question. So, we've been talking about myths, and we're sitting in our very high towers, looking down on the terrible people below us. And so, obviously, we're going to be in a situation where someone's going to say, and I was in this meeting 6 months ago with some very experienced coaches, and someone said, and all the players have got their own learning styles, so I shall do this, 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 and this. And I bit my lip because it wasn't appropriate to say something at the time. Or was it? What would be the best way to deal with that, without sort of creating further problems down the line because you just get perceived as some sort of psychology wonk?
So you obviously didn't feel psychologically safe then, Dan.
Absolutely not in that meeting, no. And there's good reasons, but that's for another day.
Really good example though, isn't it? Like there's so many situations on, I would say, a weekly basis, possibly in other environments on a daily basis, where different things that sit different with us or a different perspective is brought to the table. And I think around learning styles, we did hear loads of examples, Amy, didn't we, in the first 6 months of people saying, oh gosh, I've used the book actually as a vehicle for conversation. Just like slid it onto someone's desk when being like, oh, post it, check out this chapter, which I have done, but to a friend. But there are, I think the overarching thing for me anyway is that, and we've talked about this already, there's no shortcuts. You need to educate yourself. You need to really, if you're going to have a compelling conversation with someone where you're asking kind of thought-provoking questions or you're encouraging critical thinking, you need to have the information behind you. And so I think also that plays a key factor in building trust, the authentic and the logic side of that. You've nailed it already, Dan. I would think about time and place. I'd spoke a lot when I work with athletes or groups of people around. We can offer feedback and co-create and generate feedback, but the timing and the place is super important. I think there's, having done some work in motivational interviewing, or with it rather, there's this idea of ask, offer, and ask. Like, can you ask a little open question to see if that door is open to offer something? Or are we just saying, now's the right time, I'm going to lambaste you with my opinion on something, you're wrong, there's no learning styles, it isn't, it's resilience, not resilient, and just coming randomly out with stuff that you feel is the right time. And it isn't a discussion. So then that's an end point. I've said that I have a hierarchy, I know more, and I'm going to stop it with this, whether it's a book or a podcast that has enlightened you. And I think it's keeping that door open to have that two-way or multiple dialogues. And I think the last thing I'd offer in this area would be just patience and respect. It kind of links to the last one. We're all learning, we're all trying to do our best. The reason we get involved in sport is not always to be a millionaire. And as Amy started it around, having that thread of working with people, nourishing relationships, and having care as an underpinning, then people are just at different stages. So have the patience and pick your time to have that kind of real life example conversation.
Amy.
I'm not adding to that.
I think the lesson that has come out often is that you've got to have lots of little conversations all the time, as opposed to one big conversation. But again, it's a time appropriate matter, and there are going to be moments, and you've got to choose your moments. And that's the experience of coaching. And the fact that nothing's short term, there's no sort of, I mean, there are some quick fixes around, but generally they're not. I mean, obviously, number one quick fix is buy your book. That would be number one. But there are other things that need to be, you've got to invest time in that.
You do.
Right, we've covered a mass of subjects and wandered around some really interesting ideas. And obviously, I've got the book in front of me, and it's thoroughly recommended unless a friend pushes it onto your desk. Quietly, then, and we know that we've had some discussion that the book is hopefully out in the new version is out in September, so we'll look forward to that. But just goes for me to say thank you very much to you both for sharing. I obviously just saying something psychologically safe space isn't enough. That's my number one lesson. You're in a psychologically safe space, so you can say what you like. So I've learned a lot. So just a little bit of housekeeping to say that this is a Rugby Coach Weekly podcast. If you want to find out more about Rugby Coach Weekly, go to rugbycoachweekly.net and click on the podcast link. I shall be including links to the current book now in the show notes. And also links to be able to drop lines to Amy and Jen on some of the things they've been talking about. But thank you very much for your time and your insights.
Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.
Great,
It's weird.
great to chat. Yeah.
Great. Thank you very much, and look forward to speaking to you all very soon. Bye bye.
Thanks for listening to Rugby Coach Weekly Podcast. If you want to hear more podcasts, head over to rugbycoachweekly.net and click on the blogs tab to catch up on any episodes you've missed. We look forward to speaking to you again soon with more insights from coaches and experts from the world of rugby, sport, and learning.